cemetery. I made the mistake of looking back. The black shrouded spectre stood, dark folds rustling, one ghostly hand on the rusted gate, watching me. Its darkness was as enormous as the night, and like the night, it was all around me, pressing at me, caressing me, knowing me. I cried out and stumbled over a low gravestone. Barons caught my arm and saved me from a nasty spill.
"What is it, Miss Lane?"
"Pangs of regret. So soon." I shook my head. "Look back at the gate," I said numbly. It had never appeared to me before when someone else was around. Barons turned, scanned the old partitioned-off cemetery for several moments, then glanced back at me.
"What? I see nothing."
I turned and looked. He was right. It was gone, of course. I should have known. I sighed. "I guess I'm just a little spooked, Barons, that's all. Let's go home. There's nothing here."
"Home, Miss Lane?"
His deep voice was gently amused. "I have to call it something," I said morosely. "They say home is where the heart is. I think mine's satin-lined and 6 feet under." He opened the car door for me, the driver's side.
"Shall we dispel some of that youthful angst, Miss Lane?"
He offered me the keys.
"Not far from here, there's a road that goes on for miles, through positively desolate parts."
His dark eyes gleamed.
"Devilish curves. No traffic. Why don't you take us for a drive?"
My eyes widened. "Really?" He brushed a curl from my forehead, and I shivered. Barons has strong hands with long, beautiful fingers, and I think he carries some kind of electrical charge, because every time he touches me, it shoots an unwelcome thrill through my body. I took the keys from his hand, being careful not to make contact with skin. If he noticed, he let it pass unremarked.
"Try not to kill us, Miss Lane."
I slid behind the wheel. Viper SR-10 coupe. 6-speed, V10, 510 horses at 5,600 RPM, 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds. I babbled happily. He laughed. I kept us alive. Barely. I think it's human nature to nest. Even the homeless stake out that special park bench or spot beneath the bridge and feather it with items prized from someone's trash. Everybody wants their own safe, warm, dry place in the world, and if they don't have one, they'll do their best to create one with what they've got. I was nesting on the first floor of BB&B. I'd rearranged the furniture, stashed a boring brown throw in a closet, and replaced it with a silky yellow one, brought two peaches and cream candles down from my bedroom, plugged in my new sound dock behind the cash register, and tuned it to a cheery playlist, and propped photos of my family on top of my predecessor's TV. "Michaela Lane is here," it all said. Oop detector, monster killer by night, bookseller by day was a much-needed respite. I liked the spicy fragrance of candles burning, the clean new scent of freshly printed newspapers and glossily inked magazines. I liked ringing up sales and the sound the cash register made. I enjoyed the timeless ritual of taking money in exchange for goods. I liked the way the wood of the floors and shelves gleamed in the afternoon sun. I liked lying on my back on the counter when no one was around, trying to make out the mural on the ceiling, 4 floors above me. I enjoyed recommending great reads and discovering new ones from the customers. It all came together in a warm, nesty sort of way. At 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, I was surprised to find myself bustling around the store, humming beneath my breath and feeling almost—it took me a few moments to identify the feeling—good. Then Inspector Jane walked in. And if that wasn't bad enough, with him was my dad. 6.
"Is that your daughter, Mr. Lane?"
said the inspector. My dad stopped inside the door and peered at me hard. I touched a hand to my butchered hair, abruptly, excruciatingly aware of the bruises on my face and the spear tucked into my boot.
"Mac, baby, is that you?"
Jack Lane looked shocked, appalled,
and so relieved that I nearly burst into tears. I cleared my throat. "Hey, Dad."
"Hey, Dad?"
he echoed.
"Did you just say, hey, Dad? After all I've been through to find you, you hey, Dad me?"
Uh-oh, I was in for it. When he gets that tone, heads roll. 6 feet 2 inches of corporate tax attorney that manages the IRS on behalf of his clients and frequently bests it, Jack Lane is smart, charming, well-spoken, and tough as a tiger when provoked. And from the way he was raking back his silver-tipped dark hair and his brown eyes were flashing, he was currently very provoked. He was lucky I was still calling him Dad at all, I thought bitterly. We both knew he wasn't. He stalked toward me, eyes narrowed.
"Michaela Evelina Lane, what on earth did you do to your hair? And your face? Are those bruises? When was the last time you showered? Did you lose your luggage? You don't wear... Christ, Mac, you look awful. What happened?"
He broke off, shaking his head, then aimed a finger at me.
"I'll have you know, young lady, I left your mother with her parents 4 days ago. I dropped every case I was working on to fly over here and bring you home. Do you have any idea the heart attack it gave me to find out you hadn't been staying at the Claren House for over a week? And nobody knew where you'd gone. Could you check your email, Mac? Could you pick up a phone? I have been walking up and down these dreary, rainy, reeking with stumbling drunk streets, staring into every face, searching trash-filled alleys for you, hoping and praying to God that I wasn't going to find you lying face down in one of them like your sister, and have to kill myself rather than take the news back home to your mother and kill her with it."
The tears I'd been holding back came out in a waterfall. I might not have this man's DNA inside my body, but he couldn't be any more my father. He swallowed up the room with long-legged strides and crushed me into that great, big, barrel-chested hug that always smelled like peppermint and aftershave, and it felt just like it always did, like the safest place on earth. Unfortunately, I knew better. There was no safe place. Not for me. Not now. And certainly not for him. Not here. He'd been walking around Dublin looking for me. I blessed the fates that had spared him, steering him away from the dark zone, protecting him in those alleys from Unseelie. If anything had happened to him, it would have been doubly on my head. What had I been thinking? Avoiding my email, refusing to call home. Of course he would come looking for me. Dad never took no for an answer. I had to get him out of Dublin fast, before something awful happened to him, and I lost another piece of my heart to that satin-lined box in the earth. I had to make him fly home ASAP, and without what he'd come for. Me.
"What happened to your face, Mac?"
was the first question Dad asked me after Inspector Jane left. Though there were still 2 hours to closing, I flipped the sign and stuck a post-it next to it that said, "Sorry, closed early. Please come back tomorrow." I led him to the rear conversation area where passers-by couldn't see behind the shelves that someone was still inside. I fingered my hair nervously. It was one thing to lie to the police, another to lie to the man who had raised me, who knew I hated spiders and loved hot fudge sundaes topped with peanut butter and whipped cream.
"Inspector Jane tells me you fell on the stairs."
"What else did the inspector tell you?" I fished. How much did I have to try to explain?
"That the police officer handling Alina's case was murdered, had his throat cut, and that he'd been to see you the day it happened. Mac, what's going on? What are you doing here? What is this place?"
He craned his head around.
"Do you work here?"
I filled him in without filling him in at all. I'd realized I liked it in Dublin, I told him. I'd been offered a job that came with lodgings, so I'd moved into the bookstore. Staying in Ireland and working gave me the perfect chance to keep the pressure on the new officer handling Alina's case. Yes, I fell on the stairs. I'd had a few beers and forgotten how much stronger their Guinness was than ours. No, I had no idea why Inspector Jane didn't seem to think very highly of me. I gave Dad the same excuse I'd given Jane for O'Duffy's visit. To make it more convincing, I embellished about how fatherly and kind O'Duffy had been and what a favor he'd been doing stopping by. Crime was very high in Dublin, I told Dad, and I felt awful about O'Duffy's death, but really, police officers died on the job all the time, and Jane was just being a Jack Petunia about it to me.
And your hair?
You don't like it? It was hard to feign surprise when I hated it myself. I missed the weight of it, the different styles I'd been able to wear, the swish of it when I walked. I was just grateful he hadn't seen me when I'd still had all my splints on. He gave me a look.
You are kidding, right? Back, baby, you had beautiful hair, long and blonde like your mother's.
He trailed off. And there it was. I looked him dead in the eye. Which mother, Dad? Mom? Or the other one? You know, the one that gave me up for adoption?
You want to go get some dinner, Mac?
Men. Do they all evade as first line of defense? We ordered delivery. I hadn't had a good pizza in forever. It was starting to rain again, and I was in no mood to go out in it. I ordered, Dad paid, just like old times when life was simple, and Daddy was always there to be my Friday night date whenever my latest boyfriend had been a jerk. I gathered paper plates and napkins from Fiona's stash behind the register. Before sitting down with our pizza, I turned on all the exterior lights and lit a cozy gas fire. For now we were safe. I just had to keep him safe until morning, when I would somehow get him on a plane and send him home. I keep a happy thought inside me at all times. I cling to it in my darkest moments. When all this is over, I'm going to go back to Ashford and pretend none of this happened. I'm going to find myself a man, get married, and have babies. I need both my parents at home, waiting for me, because I'm going to make little Lane girls, and we're going to be a family again. We kept the talk light through dinner. He told me that Mom was still lost in grief and not talking to anyone. He'd hated leaving her, but he'd taken her to Graham and Gramps, and they were giving her the best of care. Thinking about Mom was too painful, so I turned the conversation to books. Dad loves to read as much as I do, and I knew that in his opinion there were far worse places he could have found me working, like another bar. We talked about new releases. I told him some of my plans for the store. When dinner was over, we pushed our plates back and regarded each other warily. He began a somber,
"You know your mother and I love you,"
spiel, and I hushed him. I knew. I didn't have any doubts on that score. I'd been forced to come to terms with so much in the past few weeks that making peace with my discovery that my parents were not my birth parents hadn't taken as long as I had expected. It had rocked my world, brutally shifted my paradigm, but regardless of whose sperm and egg had resulted in my conception, Jack and Rainy Lane had raised me with more love and unwavering support than most people ever know in a lifetime. If my biological parents were alive out there somewhere, they were my second set. I know, Dad. Just tell me.
How did you find out, Mac?
I told him an old woman had insisted I was someone else, about brown eyes and blue not making green, about calling the hospital to check on my birth records.
We knew this day might come.
He pushed a hand through his hair and sighed.
What do you want to know, Mac?
Everything, I said in a low voice. Every last detail.
It's not much.
Alina was my biological sister, wasn't she? He nodded.
She was almost three, and you were nearly a year when the two of you came to us.
Where did we come from, Dad?
They didn't tell us. In fact, they told us virtually nothing while demanding everything.
They were people from a church in Atlanta. Mom and Dad couldn't conceive, and had been on an adoption waiting list for so long they'd nearly given up. But one day they got a call that two children had been left at a downtown church, and a friend of the church's pastor's sister knew their counselor who had suggested the Lanes. Not all couples were willing to accept or had the financial means to take on two young children at once,
and among the biological mother's lengthy list of requirements was that the children not be separated. She had also insisted that if the adoptive couple did not already live in a rural area, they must move to a small town and agree to never live in or near a city again. Why?
We were told it was what it was, Mac, and we could take it or leave it.
And you didn't think it was odd?
Of course we did. Extremely. But your mother and I wanted so badly to have children and couldn't. We were young and in love and would have done just about anything to have a family of our own. Since both of us came from small towns to begin with, we took it as a sign to return to our roots. We visited dozens of towns, finally settling on Ashford. I was a successful attorney and pulled every string I could to push the adoption through. We signed all the documents, including the list of requirements, and in no time we were proud parents living in a great little town where everyone believed you were our biological daughters, leading the life we'd always dreamed of.
He smiled, reminiscing.
We fell in love with you girls the moment we saw you. Alina was wearing this yellow skirt and sweater set, and you were dressed from head to toe in pink, Mac, with a little rainbow ribbon tied around a blonde wisp of your hair.
I gaped. Does the infant mind remember? To this day, pink and rainbow hues are my favorite. What other strange requirements did the woman have? I couldn't call her our mother. She wasn't. She was the woman who had left us. He closed his eyes.
I no longer recall most of them. There's a legal document tucked away in a box somewhere that your mother and I signed. But there's one I never forgot.
I sat up a little straighter. He opened his eyes.
The first promise we had to make to the adoption agency before they'd even consider putting us on the list of prospective parents was that under no circumstances would we ever let either of you set foot in Ireland.
I couldn't get him to go home. I tried everything. In his mind, he'd violated his most sacred trust the moment he'd caved in to Alina's radiant face when she'd announced that she'd won a full scholarship to study abroad, at Trinity, of all places, by not locking her in her room and forbidding it. He should have threatened. He should have taken her car away, should have tempted her with the offer of a sporty new one if she stayed home. There were 1,000 ways he could have stopped her from going, 1,000 ways he'd failed. She had been so excited, he told me sadly. He hadn't been able to bring himself to stand in her way. Those conditions they'd agreed to so long ago had seemed as insubstantial as ghosts in the warm, sunny light of day. More than 20 perfect years had passed, and the odd demands accompanying us had lost their immediacy, become the phantom fears of a dying woman. "She's dead, then?" I asked in a hushed voice.
They never told us. We assumed. It was easier that way. We liked the finality of it. No worries that one day someone out there might come to their senses and try to take our girls away. Legal nightmares like that happen all the time.
Did you and Mom ever go back and try to find out more about us? Dad nodded.
I don't know if you recall, but Alina was very ill when she was 8, and the doctors wanted more information about her medical history than we had. We found the church had burned to the ground, the adoption agency had closed, and the private investigator I hired to look into things couldn't locate a single ex-employee.
He absorbed the look on my face and smiled faintly.
I know. Odd again. You must understand, Mac, the two of you were ours. We didn't care where you'd come from, only that you'd come. And that you're coming home with me now.
He added pointedly.
How long will it take you to pack?
I sighed. I'm not packing, Dad.
I'm not leaving without you, Mac,
he said.
You must be Jacqueline,
said Behrens. I nearly jumped out of my skin. I wish you'd quit doing that. I craned my neck to shoot him an over-the-shoulder glare. How did such a large man move so silently? Once again, he was standing behind me while I was having a conversation, and neither of us had heard him approach. It aggravated me even more that he knew my father's first name. I had never told him. Dad rose in that way big, self-assured men have, slowly, stretching to the last quarter inch of his height, and seeming to fill out even larger along the way. His expression was reserved but interested. He was curious to meet my new employer, despite the fact that he'd already decided I wouldn't be working for him anymore. His expression changed the instant he saw Barron's. It frosted, shuddered, hardened.
Jericho Barron's.
Barron's extended his hand. Dad stared at it, and for a few moments I wasn't sure he'd take it. Then he inclined his head and the men clasped hands and held. And held, like it was some kind of pissing contest, and whichever man let go first might have to forfeit a ball. I looked from one to the other, and realized that Barron's and my dad were having one of those wordless conversations he and I have from time to time. Though the language was, by nature, foreign to me, I grew up in the Deep South, where a man's ego is roughly the size of his pickup truck, and women get an early and interesting education in the not-so-subtle roar of testosterone. "She's my daughter, you prick, and if you're thinking about your prick when you're looking at her, I'll rip it off and hang you by it." "Try. You're too old for her. Leave her alone." I wanted to tell my dad he was way off base with this one, but despite the dogged determination with which I tried to interrupt and force my ocular 2 cents worth in, neither of them would look at me. "You think? I bet she doesn't think I'm too old. Why don't you ask her?" Barron said that just to irritate him. Of course, I think he's too old for me. Not that I think about him that way at all. "I'm taking her home." "Try." Barron's can be a man of annoyingly few words. "She'll choose me over you," Dad told him proudly. Barron's laughed.
"Mac, baby,"
my dad said without ever taking his eyes off Barron's.
"Get your things. We're going home."
I groaned. Of course I'd choose my dad over Barron's if given a fair choice. But it wasn't a fair choice. I hadn't been given many of them lately. I knew how my refusal was going to hurt him. And I needed to hurt him, because I needed to make him leave. "I'm sorry, Daddy, but I'm staying here," I said softly. Jack Lane flinched. His gaze cut away from Barron's to stab at me with cool reproof, but not before I saw the hurt and betrayal beneath the lawyer face he didn't paste on quick enough to mask. Barron's dark eyes gleamed. As far as he was concerned, the conversation was over. I went with Dad to the airport the next morning to see him off. Last night I wouldn't have believed I'd get him to go, and frankly I'm not sure I'm the one that did. He had stayed at the bookstore in one of the extra fourth-floor bedrooms and kept me up until 3 o'clock in the morning, arguing every angle he could think of. And believe me, attorneys can wear you out with 'em, trying to change my mind. We had done something we never do, gone to bed mad at each other. This morning, however, he'd been an entirely different man. I'd woken up to find him already downstairs, having coffee with Barron's in the study. He had greeted me with one of those big, all-encompassing hugs I love so much. He'd been relaxed, affectionate, his usual charismatic self, a man that, even at twice their age, had made most of my high school girlfriends giggle like morons. He'd been robust, cheerful, in all-around better spirits than I'd seen him since Alina's death. He had smiled and shaken Barron's hand when we'd left, with what had looked like genuine friendliness, even respect. I suppose Barron's must have confided something of himself to my father that revealed a hidden integrity of character I have yet to see, that set Jack Lane's legal eagle mind at ease. Whatever he and Barron's had found to talk about, it had worked wonders. After a quick stop at Dad's hotel to grab his luggage, a bag of croissants, and coffee, we filled our time on the way to the airport discussing one of our favorite topics, cars and the new designs unveiled at the latest auto show. At the terminal, I soaked up another hug, sent my love to Mom, promised to call soon, and managed to make it back to the bookstore just in time to open up for business. I had a good day, but I've begun to realize that's when life likes to kick you in the teeth,
the moment you start to relax and let your guard down. By 6 o'clock, I'd had 56 patrons, rung up an impressive amount of sales, and discovered that I loved being a bookseller. I had found my calling. Instead of serving drinks and watching people turn into drunken idiots, I was being paid to give people wonderful stories to escape into, full of mystery, mayhem, and romance. Instead of splashing anesthetizing alcohol into glasses, I was pouring fictional tonics to alleviate the stress, hardship, and drudgery of their lives. I wasn't corroding anybody's liver. I didn't have to watch balding, middle-aged men hitting on pretty young coeds, trying to recapture their glory days. I wasn't deluged by the sordid sob stories of the recently and so often well-deservedly jilted while I stood behind my counter. I didn't have to watch a single person cheat on their spouse, urinate on the floor, or pick a fight all day. At 6 o'clock, I should have counted my blessings and closed early. But I didn't, and just when I was starting to feel almost happy and good about myself, my life went to hell again. 7.
Nice place you have here,
said my latest customer, as the door banged shut behind him.
I wouldn't have thought the interior was so big from out on the sidewalk.
I'd had the same thought the first time I entered Barron's Books and Baubles. The building just didn't look large enough on the outside to contain all the room it held on the inside. Hi, I said. Welcome to Barron's. Are you looking for something special?
As a matter of fact, I am.
You've come to the right place, then, I told him. If we don't have the book you want in stock, we can order it, and we've got some great collectibles up on the second and third floors. He was a good-looking man in his late 20s, maybe early 30s, dark-haired and nicely built. I seem to be surrounded by attractive men lately. When I stepped around the counter, he gave me an appreciative once-over, making me glad I had dressed up. I hadn't wanted my dad to go home carrying a mental snapshot of his daughter, bedraggled, bruised, and gloomily attired, so I'd chosen my outfit with care this morning. I'd dug out a frothy peach skirt that kicked flirtatiously when I walked, a pretty camisole, and gold sandals that laced up my calves. I'd woven a brilliantly painted silk scarf through my short Arabian Night curls and knotted it at my nape, letting the ends trail across my bare shoulders. I'd taken time with my makeup, concealing my bruises and dusting a shimmery bronzer across my nose, cheeks, and breastbones. Dangly crystal earrings brushed my neck when I moved, and a single large teardrop rested in my cleavage. Glam Girl Mac felt fantastic. Savage Mac was pleased only by the spear strapped to the inside of my right thigh, and the short dirk I'd found on a display pedestal in Barron's study and strapped to my left one, and the small flashlight tucked into my pocket, and the four pairs of scissors behind the counter, and the research I'd been doing in my spare time today on gun laws in Ireland and how to go about acquiring one. I thought the semi-automatics looked good.
American, he said.
I was beginning to get the hang of being a tourist in Dublin. In college, the question was, what's your major? Abroad, everyone guesses your nationality. I nodded. And you're definitely Irish. I smiled. He had a deep voice, a lilting accent, and looked like he'd been born to wear that thick cream Irish fisherman sweater, faded jeans, and rugged boots. He moved with easy grace, born of muscle and machismo. He was a righty, I couldn't help but notice. Blushing, I busied myself neatening the evening newspapers on the counter. For the next few minutes, we indulged in the light banter of a male and female who find each other attractive and enjoy the timeless ritual of flirtation. Not everyone does, and frankly, I think it's a lost art form. Flirtation doesn't have to go somewhere. It certainly doesn't need to end up in bed. I like to think of it as a little friendlier than a handshake, a little less intimate than a kiss. It's a way of saying, hi, you look great, have a wonderful day. A tasteful flirtation, played out by people who understood the rules, leaves everyone feeling good and can perk up the bluest mood. I was certainly feeling perky by the time I steered the conversation back around to business. So what can I help you find, mister?
I nudged delicately for a name.
O'Banion.
He offered his hand.
Derek O'Banion. And I'm hoping you can help me find my brother, Rocky.
Have you ever had one of those moments when time just freezes? You know, when the world suddenly goes deathly still, and you could hear a pin drop, and the squishing sound your heart makes is so loud in your ears you feel like you're drowning in blood, and you stand there in that suspended moment and die a thousand deaths, but not really, and the moment passes and dumps you out on the other side of it with your mouth hanging open and an erased blackboard where your mind used to be? I think I've been watching too many old movies lately, in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, because the disembodied voice that offered counsel at that moment sounded a lot like John Wayne. "Buck up, little buckaroo," it said in a dry, gravelly drawl. You wouldn't believe how many things that advice has gotten me through since. When everything else is gone, balls are all any of us really have left. The question is, are yours made of flesh and blood or steel? When I shook Derek O'Banion's hand, the spear I'd stolen from his brother before I'd led him to his unwitting death burned like a brand from hell against my inner thigh. I ignored it. Goodness, is your brother missing? I blinked up at him.
Yes.
How long?
He was last seen 2 weeks ago.
How awful, I exclaimed. What brings you to our bookstore? He stared down at me, and I suddenly wondered how I could have missed the resemblance. The same cold eyes that had watched me 2 weeks ago from inside a mobster's den, wallpapered with crosses and religious iconography, gazed down at me now. Some would have pegged Rocky and his brother Derek as black Irish, but I knew from Barons, who knows everything about everyone, that the fierce, ruthless blood of a long-ago Saudi ancestor runs in O'Banion veins.
I've been stopping in at all the businesses along this street. There are 3 cars in the alley behind this shop. Do you know anything about them?
I shook my head. No, why?
They belong to associates of my brother. I was wondering if you knew when they'd been left there and why. If you heard or saw anything. Maybe a 4th black car? A very expensive one?
I shook my head again. I really don't go out back at all, and I don't much notice cars. My boss disposes of the trash. I just work here. I try to stay inside most of the time. Alleys scare me. I was babbling. I bit down lightly on the inside of my cheek to stop myself from talking. Have you spoken to the police? I encouraged. Go there. Leave here. I willed silently. Derek O'Banion's smile was sharp as knives.
O'Banions don't trouble the police with our problems. We take care of them ourselves.
He studied me with clinical detachment, all flirtation gone.
How long have you been working here?
3 days, I said truthfully.
You're new to town.
Mm-hmm.
What's your name?
Mac. He laughed.
You don't look like a Mac.
Was this safer ground presenting itself? What do I look like? I asked lightly, leaning a hip against the counter and subtly arching my spine. Go back to flirting with me, my body posture invited. He scanned me from head to toe.
Trouble,
he said after a moment, with a faint, sexually charged smile. I laughed. I'm really not.
Too bad,
he parried. But I could tell his mind wasn't fully on flirting. It was on his brother. And something else I could completely understand. It was on a hunt for the truth, for retribution. What vagaries of fate had made kindred souls of us, me and this man? Oh, excuse me, it hadn't been vagaries. It was me. He took a business card from his wallet, a pen from his pocket, and scribbled on the back.
If you should see or hear anything, you'll tell me, won't you, Mac?
He took my hand, turned it palm up, and dropped a kiss in it before the card.
Any time, day or night, anything, no matter how inconsequential you think it seems.
I nodded.
I think he's dead,
Derek O'Banion told me.
And I'm going to destroy the fuck that did it.
I nodded again.
He was my brother.
I nodded a third time. My sister was murdered, I blurted. His gaze sharpened with new interest. I was suddenly more in his eyes than another flirty, pretty girl.
Then you understand vengeance, he said softly.
I understand vengeance, I agreed.
Call me any time, Mac,
he said.
I think I like you.
I watched him leave in silence. When the door closed behind him, I raced to the bathroom, locked myself in, and leaned back against the door, where I stood staring at myself in the mirror, trying to reconcile the dual images. I was hunting the monster that had killed my sister. I was the monster that had killed his brother. When I came out of the bathroom, I glanced around, relieved to find no customers had entered the store. I'd forgotten to slap one of the back-in-5-minute signs that I'd made up yesterday to cover my bathroom breaks on the front door. I hurried now to turn over the sign. Once again, I was closing early. Barron's was just going to have to deal with it. It wasn't much early, and it wasn't like he needed the money. As I flipped the placard, I made the mistake of glancing out of the window. It was nearly dark, that time of day folks around these parts call gloaming, or twilight, when the day gently bruises into night. And I was unable to decide which was worse, Inspector Jane sitting on a bench a few doors down to the right, not even pretending to be reading the newspaper he held, the black-shrouded spectre standing directly across the street, watching me from beneath the ashy shadows of a dimly flickering street lamp, or Derek O'Banion exiting a shop 2 doors down, turning left, and heading straight into the dark zone.
"Where the hell have you been?"
Barron's yanked open the cab door and pried me out with a hand around my upper arm. My feet left the ground for a moment. "Don't start with me," I growled. Shaking off his grip, I pushed past him. Inspector Jane's cab was just pulling up behind me. I wonder if he missed his family yet. I hoped he'd get tired of me soon and go home.
"I'm getting you a cell phone, Ms. Lane,"
he barked at my back.
"You will carry it at all times like the spear. You will do nothing without it. Need I remind you of all the things you won't be doing without it?"
I told him where he could put my as-yet-unpurchased cell phone. The sun didn't shine there, and I didn't call it by a flower's name, and stomped into the store. He stomped in after me.
"Have you forgotten the dangers out there in the Dublin night, Miss Lane? Shall we go for a little walk?"
Once before, when he thought I was being intractable, he'd threatened to drag me into the dark zone at night. Tonight, I was too numb to care. Deadbolts rang out like bullets against steel as he slammed them home.
"Have you forgotten your purpose here, Miss Lane?"
"How could I?" I said bitterly. "Every time I try to, something worse happens." I was halfway to the connecting doors when he caught me and spun me around. He gave me a furious once-over that seemed to get tangled up for a moment on the crystal dangling between my breasts. Or was it my breasts?
"And there you are, dressed like a 2-bit floozy, going out for a drink. What the fuck were you thinking? Were you thinking?"
2-bit floozy? Get with the times, Barron's. I don't look like a 2-bit anything. In fact, I'm positively overdressed by lots of people's standards these days, and certainly wearing more than that stupid little black dress you made me wear when we... I broke off. Where I'd worn that skimpy halter dress was hitting too close to home right now. "And for the record," I said stiffly, "I did not go out for a drink."
"Don't lie to me, Miss Lane. I smell it on you. And other things. Who was the man?"
His dark, exotic face was cold. His nostrils flared and constricted like an animal scenting prey. Barron's has extraordinary senses. I'd not had even the tiniest sip of alcohol. "I said I didn't have a drink," I repeated. "I'd had an awful night, one of the absolute worst of my life."
"You had something. What was it?"
he demanded. "An alcohol-laced kiss," I said tightly. 2, to be precise. But only because I hadn't moved fast enough to avoid the second one. I turned away, hating myself, hating my choices.
His hand shot out and closed on my shoulder. He spun me back to him with such vehemence that I might have whirled in dizzying top-like circles if he hadn't caught me by the shoulders. He seemed to realize he was holding me too hard at the precise moment I was about to snap at him, and his fingers relaxed on my skin. But his body seemed to doubly absorb the tension. His gaze dropped to my necklace again, to its soft cushion between my breasts.
From who?
From whom, I believe, is the correct phrasing.
All right. From the fuck whom, Miss Lane?
Derek O'Banion. Any other questions? He regarded me a moment, then a slow half-smile curved his lips. Just as O'Banion had earlier, he suddenly seemed to find me much more interesting.
Well, well.
He brushed the pad of his thumb across my mouth, then cupped my chin and angled my face back up to the light, searching my eyes. For a moment, I thought he was going to kiss me himself, to taste the complexity and complicity of me. Or was that duplicity?
And you were kissing the brother of the man you killed? Why?
He murmured silkily. I didn't kill him, I said bitterly. You killed him without my permission.
Bollocks, Miss Lane, he said. If I'd asked you that night if you wanted him dead so you could be safe, you'd have said yes.
I remembered that night. I would remember it forever. I'd been freaked out by the rapidity with which my life was unraveling, terrified of Rocky O'Banion, and fully aware that if we didn't do something about him, he was going to do something very bad and no doubt unspeakably painful to me. I have no delusions about my ability to withstand torture. Behrens was right. I would have said, do whatever you have to do to keep me safe. But I didn't have to like it, and I didn't have to admit it. I turned and walked away.
I want you to go to the Ancient Languages Department at Trinity College tomorrow morning, Miss Lane.
I drew up like he'd yanked my leash and scowled up at the ceiling. Was something cosmic up there playing tricks on me? Was the whole universe in on a great big let's mess with Mac joke? The Ancient Languages Department was the only place in all of Dublin I'd made a mental note never to go. You're kidding, right?
No. Why?
Forget it, I muttered. What do you want me to do there?
Ask for a woman named L. Masters. She'll have an envelope for you.
Why don't you go get it yourself? What did he do all day?
I'm busy tomorrow.
So go get it tonight.
She won't have it until morning.
Then have her send it by courier.
Who's the employer here, Miss Lane?
Who's the oop detector?
Is there some reason you don't want to go to the university?
No. I was in no mood to talk about dreamy-eyed guys and dates I could never have.
Then what, Miss Lane, is your problem?
Shouldn't I be afraid the Lord Master might get me while I'm out and about?
Were you worrying about that tonight when you were letting Derek O'Banion shove his tongue down your throat?
I stiffened. He was walking into the dark zone, Behrens.
So? One less problem for us.
I shook my head. I'm not you, Behrens. I'm not dead inside. His smile was 10 shades of ice.
So what did you do? Run after him and offer yourself on a silver platter to get him to turn around?
Pretty much. And then I'd had to spend the next 3.5 hours in a downtown club, dancing and flirting with him and trying to keep his hands off me, while Inspector Jane watched from a corner table. Trying to use up so much of his time that he would be disinclined to go back and search the dark zone tonight. Eventually, trying to beg off nicely and failing. Like his brother, Derek O'Banion was used to getting what he wanted, and if he didn't, he pushed harder. In my blind determination to avert culpability in another death, I'd forgotten he was related to the man who'd brutally murdered 27 people in a single night to get what he wanted. By 11:30, I'd had as much as I could take. With each drink he tossed back, he had sprouted more hands and a worse attitude. I hadn't been able to extricate myself gracefully, so, in a fit of desperation, I'd excused myself for the bathroom and tried to sneak out a side door. I'd figured I would call him tomorrow, pretend I'd gotten sick, and if he asked me out again, evade, procrastinate, and lie. I really hadn't wanted another O'Banion pissed off at me in this city. One had been bad enough. He'd caught me outside the bathroom, shoved me into a wall, and kissed me so brutally that I hadn't been able to breathe. Flattened between his body and a brick wall, I'd grown light-headed from lack of oxygen. My mouth still felt swollen, bruised. I'd seen the excitement in his eyes and known he was a man turned on by a woman's helplessness. I'd remembered his brother's restaurant, the carefully coiffed and tightly controlled women, how the waiters were forbidden to serve a woman a meal or a drink unless a man ordered for them. O'Banions were not nice men. When I'd finally wrested myself free, I'd made a scene, loudly accusing him of forcing his attentions on me when I'd already told him a dozen times I wasn't interested. If he'd been anyone else, the bouncers would have tossed him out of the club. But in Dublin, nobody tosses an O'Banion. They'd throw me out instead. The tape to my derriere inspector had watched it all through narrowed eyes, arms folded, without lifting a finger to help me. I made another enemy in this city tonight, as if I didn't already have enough. Still, I had accomplished my goal, and it hadn't been an easy one to tackle. When I'd looked out the window and seen Derek O'Banion heading straight for his deadly rendezvous with the Shades, I'd wanted nothing more than to flip the sign, lock the door, curl up with a good book, and pretend nothing was out there, and nothing bad was about to happen. But it seems I've got this set of scales inside me that I never used to have, or at least I wasn't aware of, and I can't shake the feeling that if I don't try to keep them balanced, I'll lose something I won't be able to get back. So I had forced myself out of the bookstore and into the rapidly deepening dusk. I'd rolled my eyes at the inspector and ground my teeth against the oppressive sense of dread that cloaked me every time I saw that terrifying black specter watching, waiting. I had notched my chin higher and made myself walk straight past it like it didn't even exist. And as far as I could tell, it didn't, because Jane had ignored it, and O'Banion sure hadn't looked at it on the way back. But then again, I had tugged my camisole down to reveal a shocking amount of cleavage to tempt him to turn around. I'd done for one O'Banion what I'd failed to do for the other, and the scales inside me had leveled a little. I hoped he'd continue his search tomorrow, in the daylight, and not stop in here on his way by. But if, despite my efforts, he went back into the abandoned neighborhood tonight, well, I'd done the best I could, and frankly I wasn't sure how important it was another O'Banion remained among the living. Dad says hell has a special place for men who abuse women. There are unseelie monsters, and there are human ones.
"Was he a good kisser, Miss Lane?"
Behrens asked, watching me carefully. I wiped my mouth with the back of my hand at the memory. It was like being owned.
"Some women like that."
"Not me."
"Perhaps it depends on the man doing the owning."
"I doubt it. I couldn't breathe with him kissing me."
"One day you may kiss a man you can't breathe without, and find breath is of little consequence."
"Right, and one day my prince might come."
"I doubt he'll be a prince, Miss Lane. Men rarely are."
"I'll get your envelope, Behrens. What then? What crazy zig was my life going to zag down next?"
"I took the liberty of placing garments in your room. Tomorrow evening we leave for Wales."
Turned out L. Masters wasn't there the next day, nor, much to my relief, was the dreamy-eyed guy. Instead, I met a fourth-year student who worked for L. and was holding the envelope for me. He was tall, with dark hair, a great Scottish accent, a ton of curiosity about Behrens, who he'd heard about from his employer, I guess, and pretty dreamy eyes himself, an unusual shade of amber, like tiger eyes, framed by thick black lashes. "Scotty," we never got around to introducing ourselves, I was in too much of a hurry to get out of there and on with my day, "told me L's 6-year-old daughter was sick, and she was keeping her out of school, so he'd swung by to pick up the envelope on his way into work." I took it and hurried out the door. Scotty followed me halfway down the hall, making small talk with a charming Scots burr,
and I got the distinct impression that he was working up to asking me out. Two gorgeous guys in the same department, two normal guys. I would only be torturing myself if I spared a second thought for either of them. The ancient languages department at Trinity was off limits for me in the future. Behrens could run his own errands, or hire a courier service to do it for him. On my way back to the bookstore, I pretended not to see nearly a dozen unseelie rhino boys escorting their new protégés down the street, shaping them up for human society. They pointed and spoke, their charges nodded, and it was obvious they were being indoctrinated into their new world. My world. I wanted to stab every one of them with my spear as I walked by, but I refrained. I'm not in this for the little battles. I'm here for the war. All of them were casting fey glamours to make themselves appear human to varying degrees of attractiveness, but either they were rudimentary efforts, or I've gotten better at penetrating the fey facade, because aside from a momentary blurriness, a brief vacillation of color and contour, I saw them in their true forms. None were as revolting as the hideous gray man who'd preyed on women, stealing their beauty through the open sores in his flesh and hands, although all made me feel queasy. But that's just the effect of any fey on my she-seer senses. It's my early warning system. I picked up a group of 10 of them on my radar, a full 2 blocks before encountering their little monster posse. I counted 3 new types of unseelie I would make notes on later in my journal, perhaps on the plane to Wales tonight. When I got back to the bookstore, I steamed open the envelope. The adhesive edge curled quickly, and the glue seemed sparse, making me wonder if I'd not been the first to do it. It held an invitation, an exclusive one, extended by a host who denoted himself or herself with only a symbol, no address. On the back was jotted a partial list, intended to tantalize. It included an object long held to be mythical, 2 religious icons the Vatican was rumored to be looking for, and a painting by one of the masters believed lost in a fire centuries ago. Behrens and I were going to an auction tonight, a very private one, the kind of black market sale Interpol and FBI agents nurture sweet, career-making dreams of one day busting. 8. Wales is one of 4 constituent or home nations of the United Kingdom. England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland are the other 3. Ireland, not to be confused with Northern Ireland, is a sovereign state and a member of the European Union. The entire United Kingdom, at about 94,000 square miles, is slightly smaller than the state of Oregon. The island of Ireland, both Northern and the Republic, is roughly the size of the state of Indiana. At 8,000 square miles, Wales is tiny. To put Wales in perspective, Scotland has 4 times the land mass, and Texas is 33 times as big. I know all of this because I looked it up. When my sister was killed and I was forced, wings untried, from my gently feathered nest in Ashford, Georgia, my eyes were opened in more ways than one. I took stock of myself and realized that, among other things, I had no global awareness. I've been trying desperately to dispel my provinciality by teaching myself a bird's-eye view of things. If knowledge is power, I want all of it I can get. The flight from Dublin to Cardiff took a little over an hour. We landed in Roos, about 10 minutes from the capital city, at 11:15. A chauffeur fell into step beside us and ushered us into a waiting silver Maybach 62. I have no idea where we went from there, because I've never been inside such a car, and was too busy examining the luxurious interior to notice much more than city lights whizzing by, and finally darkness beyond the panoramic glass roof. I reclined my seat to nearly horizontal. I tested the massage option. I stroked the soft leather and the gleaming wood. I watched the velocity with which we hurtled into the night on the sealing instruments.
"When we arrive, you will take your seat and not move,"
Behrens said for the 5th time.
"Do not scratch your nose, fidget with your hair, rub your face, and no matter what I say to you, you must not nod. Speak to me, but softly. People will listen, if they can. Be discreet.
Still as a cat, quiet as a mouse, I replied, flipping through the movie selections for my personal flat-screen TV. The car was capable of what critics called a blistering performance, achieving 0 to 100 in 5 seconds. Behrens must be a serious collector for our host to have sent such a car after him. I didn't become aware of my surroundings again until Behrens was helping me from the car, tucking my arm through his. I liked my attire tonight better than anything he'd chosen for me in the past. I had on a black Chanel suit that was all business, sexy heels that weren't, and fake diamonds at my ears, wrists, and throat. I had sleeked my short dark curls with a leave-in conditioner and tucked it behind my ears. I looked like money, and liked how it felt. Who wouldn't? Up until now, the most expensive outfit I'd ever worn was my prom dress. I always figured the next expensive dress I'd get to wear would be the one my daddy bought me for my wedding, and if life was good, about half a dozen more between that and my funeral. I certainly never would have wagered on haute couture and fancy cars and illegal auctions and men who wore silk shirts and Italian suits with platinum and diamond cufflinks. When I finally glanced around, I was startled to find we were on a deserted country lane. Stiff men in stiffer suits herded us a short distance down a shadowy path through the woods, stopping us in front of an overgrown bank. I was perplexed until they parted the dense foliage, revealing a steel door in the side of an embankment. We were guided through it, down an endless, narrow flight of concrete stairs, through a long concrete tunnel lined with pipes and wires, and into a large, rectangular room.
"We're in a bomb shelter,"
Behrens said against my ear,
"nearly 3 stories beneath the ground."
I don't mind telling you it creeped me out more than a little, being so deep in the earth with only one way out, and that back the way we'd come, through a dozen heavily armed men. I'm not claustrophobic, but I like the open sky around me, or at least the knowledge that it's right on the other side of whatever walls I'm enclosed by. This felt like being buried alive. I think I'd rather die in a nuclear holocaust than live in a concrete box for 20 years.
"Lovely," I murmured. "Is this kind of like your underground?"
Ow! Behrens's boot was on my foot, and if he gave it any more pressure, it'd be flat as a pancake.
"There are times and places for curiosity, Miss Lane. This is not one of them. Here, anything you say can and will be used against you."
"Sorry," I said, and I really was. If he didn't want these people to know he had an underground vault, I could understand that. And if I'd not been so discombobulated by my surroundings, I would have thought of that before I'd brought it up. "Get off my foot." He gave me a Behrens look that defies describing because he has several of them, and they speak volumes. "I'm alert, I swear," I said crossly. I hate being a fish out of water, and not only was I flopping around on the beach, I was a minnow among sharks. "And I won't say another word unless you speak to me, okay?" He gave me a tight, satisfied smile, and we headed for our seats. The room was concrete from top to bottom, with no finishing touches. Exposed pipes and wires ran the length of the ceiling. 40 metal folding chairs had been set up in the room, 5 rows of 4 each on both sides of a narrow aisle. Most of the chairs were already filled with people in elegant evening attire. Those conversing did so in hushed murmurs. At the front of the room was a center podium flanked by tables, covered with items draped in velvet. Additional draped items lined the wall behind it. Behrens looked at me. I was careful not to nod. "Yes," I told him, as we took our seats in the 3rd row on the right side of the room. I had been feeling it ever since we'd entered the shelter, but I'd had no way of knowing if it was a fey relic or an actual fey, until I had the opportunity to examine all persons in the vicinity. There were no glamours being cast. The occupants of this room were human, which meant there was a very powerful oop under all that velvet somewhere. On a nausea scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the she-sedu,
and most other things topping out at a 3 or 4, with nothing so far between 6 and 10 but the single 10 that had made me lose consciousness. It was a 5, and I thumbed from my pocket one of the Tums I'd begun taking to help with the discomfort of carrying the spear all the time, which, by the way, I'd left on Barron's desk earlier at his direction, so he could strap it to his leg, not mine. I had hated giving it up, but my sleek suit afforded no hiding places. Though there was little trust between us, I knew he would return it to me quickly if I needed it.
"The door closes at midnight."
His lips brushed my ear, and I shivered, which seemed to amuse him.
"Anyone not inside by then doesn't get in. There are always a couple of last-minute stragglers.